Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, and in advance, happy Thanksgiving. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at Quip, and we are joined by our friend Peter Wehner, one of the earliest guests on the Bulwark Podcast, and it is good to have you back again, Peter.
It's great to be on. It's always good to have a conversation with you, Charlie. Thanks.
Well, I am struggling with optimism and hope today. I have to admit this. Given the trajectory of events and the kinds of things that we have to talk about today, including whether or not opponents of Donald Trump are demonic and whether or not Donald Trump is God's chosen one. This is one of those moments where I'm debating whether or not just to slam my head on the desk, take up day drinking, or try to discuss it. But right before we started the podcast, I said I looked up the distinction that Rabbi Sacks had made between optimism and hope, because they're not the same thing, are they? Right. And that's kind of, because I wrote something, you know, talking about the hope for the coalition of the decent, which does seem like the triumph of hope over experience. And just bear with me, Peter. This is what Rabbi Sacks wrote. He said, optimism and hope are not the same thing. Optimism is the belief that the world is changing for the better. Hope is the belief that together we can make the world better. Optimism is a passive virtue. Hope is an active one. It needs no courage to be an optimist, but it takes a great deal of courage to hope. The Hebrew Bible is not an optimistic book. It is, however, one of the great literatures of hope. So I'm willing to say that I am struggling to hope, although I'm not really feeling like I'm an optimist.
Yeah, no, that's a very nice distinction that Rabbi Sacks made. I'm not even sure optimism is a virtue, whereas I think hope probably is. But I do think that hope is deeper, and I also like that distinction between passive and active. Optimism is often, I suppose, a predilection, a predisposition that just assumes things will always turn out well, whether in fact the reality and circumstances should properly lead one to that conclusion. Whereas, as you say, hope is a sense, I think, of where one has to go, and that the forces and powers and goodness and decency in people can be summoned to get us to where we have to go. So, one can be a theoretical optimist, but they ought to be an operational optimist, a person who's operationally hopeful. And I think that's the way we have to approach life. Sometimes things seem dark, and the facts seem to align against one, and things look hard. But we're called to be faithful, not to be successful. And people have to act in their own lives to nudge the world in a better direction. If enough people do that, things will happen. Things will get better.
Yeah, no, I think that's well put. That optimism is a mood, but hope is a policy. So let's dive into all of this. We talked about this on the podcast yesterday, but I really wanted to talk to you about all of this. You know, there's a moment when you think that Rick Perry's comments that President Trump are the chosen one is sort of a one-off. Okay, it's Rick Perry. We can't take it too seriously. This can't be something that we need to engage with. But apparently that is not the case. Let me play you a soundbite. It's about a minute long from a political consultant named Alice Stewart, who I think used to be Ted Cruz's spokesman, and she goes on CNN, and she is asked by the host, what does she think of Rick Perry's comments? And this is what Alice Stewart had to say.
Right. Tell me, what was your reaction when you heard Rick Perry say this about the chosen one and the president of the United States?
I say he is 100% correct.
Really?
As a woman of faith, as a Christian, I truly believe God is sovereign. All authority comes from God. And when it came down to who God thought should lead this country at this time, he decided, for whatever reason, that it should be Donald Trump. Just as he did when it was Barack Obama, when it was George Bush, Bill Clinton, I truly believe, as a Christian, this was God's divine choice at this time. And this is what God wanted. And a lot of people might take what Rick Perry said and say, how can someone look at someone like Donald Trump and say he is the one that God specifically chose? That is the way it is. And as a person of faith, that's how I view it. And I know exactly what Rick Perry was meaning to say when he said that. And it is because God is the sovereign God.
So, Peter, this is one of those moments where, okay, is this what Christianity has become? Because we think of God as a sovereign God, we have to think that somehow he has installed Donald Trump as the president of the United States, that Donald Trump is the instrument of the Almighty?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of theological confusion surrounding that. And I think that people are conflating different categories. If what they mean by saying that Donald Trump is chosen by God, that God is sovereign, I think most people of the Christian faith would agree. But if they are arguing that he is approved by God, and indeed that every act that happens in history because God is sovereign is something that has the imprimatur of God, I think that's simply wrong. You couldn't find anything biblically that said that this idea about chosen leaders applies only to the United States. Would Rick Perry argue that Kim Jong-un is chosen by God, that Mussolini was chosen by God, that Stalin was chosen by God? And if that is the argument, what are we supposed to make of it? Are we supposed to make of it that God actively install those people to do the works that they did? And of course, in the Old Testament, you have person after person, figure after figure, who challenged evil leaders precisely because they were acting in evil ways. So I think there's just a lot of theological confusion. And I think that for a lot of people of the Christian faith who were conservative, there is this conflation that is going on. And they're really searching out ways to defend Donald Trump, but also I think to defend their defense of Donald Trump, and to try and remove some of the cognitive dissonance that has to creep into their minds and hearts from time to time.
I want to come back to the religious consequences of this kind of attitude, but I mean the political consequences are pretty disturbing, because there's a long history of people using divine sanction in order to justify who's ever in power. And we seem to be going back to that. This is not something that I'd heard before, but I mean, obviously there was a time when people justified slavery as something that, well, it must be instituted by God. Other rulers who pursued policies that would be objectively evil found defenders, people saying, well, you know, he is God's anointed one. I mean, what is disturbing is the way in which this argument then becomes a moral shield not to have moral standards, not to have a sense of moral outrage.
No, I think that's very well said. It is a kind of moral shield. I mean, people of the Christian faith are called to do in terms of their work in this world is to advance Christ's values in the world, so kingdom values, and to act in ways that advances justice and decency and the moral good. And those are the kinds of things that ought to guide our actions and our conduct. And I do worry that there are an awful lot of white evangelical Christians who are supporters of Donald Trump. Not all, by any means. It's a large movement, and a lot of people are conflicted on Donald Trump. But there are some large number of white evangelical Christians who will use their faith as a sword and a shield for Donald Trump, both to defend him and also to attack those who are critical of him. And that is one of the things that troubles me most about this moment. It's not new to this moment. It's been around for almost as long as faith and human beings have been around. I will say that throughout my life in politics, I've noticed really ever since I got into politics how easy it is for people of the Christian faith to subordinate their faith to politics. That is, politics becomes the prism by which they view things, and faith is conformed to fit into what their ideological predilections are.
Why is that?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. I think because I'd say that there are several things that are at play. One is that for a lot of people, political ideology is extremely dominant, and they are part of a political tribe. And we begin to take on the characteristics of the tribe in which we're in, and our thinking gets distorted. And then you begin to convince yourself that your tribe is right, the other tribe is wrong. And you have to advance the values and the agenda of your team as opposed to the other team. And because they often view these struggles in an existential way, they'll say, we've got to marshal, you know, every argument that we can. We have to adjust scripture to advance that agenda because the values that we care about are at stake. I also think as well that for a lot of people of the Christian faith, and this is a struggle, and I have my struggles as well, which is one's own intimacy with Christ is not deep. Our faith becomes distant and cold. There's a kind of check the box quality to it, and the real passions of people's lives is found not in faith, but in politics. So I think that is part of it too.
But see, what I find puzzling is, of course, Christianity is a story. It's a narrative. And it is relating to other figures within the gospel, for example. And so we've gone from, I'll ask you this question. Why do these evangelical Christians right now identify more with the emperor in the stands than with the martyrs there in the middle of the Colosseum? I mean, it used to be for a very, very, very long time that Christians identified with the martyrs, with the people who would stand on principle, the people who would be, in any secular sense of the word, the losers, the dissenters, the people who were cast out. And now it's basically like, well, no, you know, God chose Caligula. God chose Commodus. We need to be respectful of him. And these people who are, you know, making trouble are whatever. But it is a shift of focus, isn't it?
Oh, it's a huge shift of focus. Of course, if you look through the history of the Christian church and you see when has the Christian church flourished most, it's not when it's had political power, but actually often the opposite. And Christianity itself, unlike other faiths, is not a religion of political power at its core. Indeed, it's often the opposite. I think there are several things that explain what has happened and why Christians align with those in power. Some of it, I think, is just frankly the seduction of power, which probably all of us to some degree or another struggle with. In my experience, Charlie, I'll tell you that I would say that Christians who are involved in politics are the most easily seduced by power of probably any group that I've seen in my life. I think part of it is
that is remarkable.
David Brooks in his book The Second Mount talks about Christians that he's come across who have a spiritual superiority and intellectual inferiority complex. It's a dangerous combination, and I think that intellectual inferiority complex plays into that. It's a sense of wanting to be esteemed by the world, recognized by the world, and have your hands on power to try and shape the world. A second thing that I think explains it is fear. There's a tremendous amount of fear, almost an existential fear, about the course and state of American culture, and pulsating fear that if Democrats get the White House, that they're able to make Supreme Court choices, that really so much of what these people know and love will be destroyed, that a kind of darkness will descend upon the land. A third thing is, in the case of Donald Trump, as you know, a lot of evangelicals view him as a kind of protector, a fierce fighter who's going to bring a pistol to a cultural knife fight. And so it's not his faith that they care about so much, or even his ethics so much, but it's a sense that he will protect us from those who want to harm us. And indeed, the way he fights, the viciousness, the dehumanization, and the cruelty, is, they think, an effective weapon. There's a lot of built-up resentment and anger in a lot of white evangelicals. Some of it is understandable because they've been dishonored and patronized over the years by elite culture, so I understand that. But I think it's gone way too far, and there's a kind of psychic satisfaction now among evangelical Christians and Donald Trump, that when he attacks the people that they think hate him, they take a certain delight in that.
There's no question about it that there was a time when they would say, we support Donald Trump, in spite of his personality and those tactics. Now I think it's really, in part, it's because they like that. They actually like that approach. So before we just move on, I want to go to this question of God choosing versus, say, free will. So Eric Erickson put out a tweet yesterday saying, it is not a controversial opinion to say that God chose Trump. It's scriptural. God ultimately gives us our leaders. He also gives us plagues. But God put Obama into leadership and then Trump. He also sends locusts and turns rivers to blood. Now, I sort of snarkily, subtweeted that saying, define the word controversial, because I'm not sure that everybody would agree with all of that. But is that the standard evangelical theology now, that God, that if someone is elected president or, you know, becomes the chancellor of Germany, that this is because God gave us that person as the leader? I mean, are there times when God allows us to make choices, and we make choices, and they are terrible choices, they are craptacular choices, but it's our choice, not God's?
Yeah, well, you put your finger on what is a long and complicated theological debate. There are verses in the Bible that evangelical Christians will go to and choose from that will say that God ordains leaders. In Romans 13, when Paul was talking about Nero, he's talking about those in authority are chosen by God. So there's a scriptural basis for it. I just think that you have to take that into account, partly when Paul wrote, the context in which he wrote. You have to take into account, as I said earlier, the fact that there are plenty of figures, admirable, noble, honorable figures in the Bible who stand up to those in power, and who say that justice demands that we push back against it. And of course, you've raised the question, and I have as well, which is, what exactly does it mean when you say God has chosen these people? Does that mean that He has approved them? That those people have His imprimatur? And if that's the case, what is the argument to those who say, well, vote Obama out of office? If your argument is that, or Kim Jong-un, again, or Mussolini, if God has ordained those people and has put them there, then are individuals supposed to take it upon themselves to get rid of them? Of course not. You have to act as sovereign agents in your life. You have to do things that you think advance justice and decency and the common good. And that's what I worry about. What exactly are they arguing? If they're arguing that Donald Trump was chosen by God and therefore he's there and he shouldn't be criticized and he shouldn't be removed from office, that God approves of what he's doing, that's just, I think, folly. And I can't believe that if you press that argument to its end point, again, Kim Jong-un, there's nothing for Christians to say, well, this applies only to America. If every leader is chosen by God, then what do Christians have to say to those who are massacring and persecuting Christians throughout the world? Are we supposed to be indifferent to that? Or are we supposed to be passive before it? Are we simply supposed to shrug our shoulders and say, well, God has chosen them? I don't think so. And I don't think that that's the arc or the ethic of the Bible.
It obviously becomes very complicated because, of course, if God chose Pharaoh, he also chose Moses, right, to stand up to Pharaoh.
Right.
So this leads us obviously
Can I just very quickly, before we go, I think probably the way for Christians to approach this is to say, I don't know if God chose this person. I don't know exactly how that all plays out. What I do know is that we're called to act on behalf of justice, and that we should take it upon ourselves within our sphere of influence to do what we can to advance God's kingdoms and God's values. And if you see people at any level of life, whether it's political or any other arena of life, that are acting in ways that are injurious to the weak, to the dispossessed, that treat people without human dignity, promoting persecution and hardship, you should stand against it. So you can have an abstract theological debate about whether God chose or didn't chose Donald Trump or anybody else. But what we're called to do is in real time to act as sovereign individuals and to make the judgments that most align with what we deem to be Christian virtues.
I agree with that. And I was going to mention before, you know, I look at this moment and think, I don't know whether God chose Donald Trump or not. I doubt that. But I do know that he expects something of us. So the question you have to ask yourself, to interrogate yourself, is, you know, what am I supposed to do at this moment? What does God expect of me at this particular moment? To go along with it, to acquiesce, to sacrifice certain values, to pretend to believe certain things that I don't. I want to take a deeper dive into this, because obviously, if in fact the president is the chosen one, because you wrote a long piece in The Atlantic about the comments by Franklin Graham and Eric Metaxas about opposition being demonic, and there's real consequences as well, and they're both religious consequences, the consequences are both religious and political, and some of them are rather, I would think, frightening. So let's talk about that, but let's hear a word from our sponsor first. Today's episode is brought to you by Quip, makers of the Quip electric toothbrush. This is something I actually have. I've been using it for months now, and they want you to know that the one single discovery that matters most for your dental care is simply this. If you have good habits, you're good. That means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day and flossing regularly, no matter what brand you use. But Quip makes that simple. Starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer and 30-second pulses to guide a full and even clean. And the Quip floss dispenser comes with pre-marked string to help you use just enough. Plus, Quip delivers fresh brush heads, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. You never run out. You don't have to run to the store. It comes right to you. Join more than 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today, starting at $25. And if you go to getquip.com/sykes, that's S-Y-K-E-S, right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/sykes, S-Y-K-E-S. Let me spell that out. GETQUIP.com/sykes. Quip, the good habits company. Okay, we're back with Peter Wehner. I suppose I was okay with being described as a Trump opponent as being human scum, Peter, but apparently that's not sufficient. Now we are demonic. And I have your piece here. You wrote a piece. Are Trump critics demonically possessed? And then you have this line, which, let's see here. But then, you know, quoting Franklin Graham and Eric Metaxas having this conversation about whether or not people who oppose the president's agenda are in fact demonic, whether they are enemies, it's a spiritual warfare. And then you write, there is no biblical or theological case to support the claim. The critics of Donald Trump are under the spell of Satan. It is invented out of thin air, a shallow, wild, and reckless charge meant to be a conversation stopper. Well, Peter, good to know.
No, I know.
Who
knew we'd get to the point where you have to say in public that there's no biblical support to claim that critics of Trump are under the spell of Satan. But I give you the times. Yeah, this was an interview that Franklin Graham did with Eric Metaxas, mm-hmm. who's a radio talk show host on the Salem Radio Network. And Metaxas is a well-known author. Yeah, no, he wrote a biography on Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which was popular, mm-hmm. A bit slipshod, I think, in his scholarship, but popular, and also a book I believe on Wilberforce,
which I've read.
Yeah, no, and he used to oversee something called Socrates in the City, and he's an engaging person, and he's clever. But I just think that in this moment, in his devotion to Donald Trump, he's really jumped the rails. Both he and Franklin Graham are deeply, deeply devoted and almost obsequious supporters of Donald Trump. And in the course of this interview, Metaxas was asking Graham, lamenting the fact that there are people who exist to, in Metaxas' words, undermine the president of the United States. And Graham said, well, I believe it's almost a demonic power that's trying. And that's when Metaxas interrupted and said, I disagree. It's not almost demonic. It's a spiritual battle. And off to the races they went. The reason I chose to write on this is for several reasons. One is that these are two prominent figures within the American evangelical movement, and I think when they say that kind of reckless thing, it needs to be challenged.
This is an important point. These are not fringe characters. These are people with huge followings and huge audiences.
No, that's right. They really do. It's a kind of Christian subculture, but a lot of people are in it, and this is the kind of thing that their audiences are listening to. Politics has enough passions by itself, but if you overlay that with religious faith, and you begin to make the argument that we're the children of light, they're the children of darkness, we are the champions of God, they are the defenders of Satan. That adds a whole new element to this kind of struggle. This, by the way, is the kind of thing which informed John Locke's thinking and the American founders when they were decided that there had to be a distance between faith and politics, because Locke, as you know, had witnessed the religious wars that had been going on for two centuries, and knew that if you interject religious faith and the passions that can accompany religious faith into politics, it can make things a lot worse. Now, the flip side of that is that I think that religious faith, properly understood, can add a great deal to politics. It can humanize it. It can advance justice. So it's a balance wheel. But that's the danger. And what people like Franklin Graham and Eric Metaxas are doing is that they are, I think, both discrediting the Christian witness and their theology is deeply confused. And they are also making our politics, setting up our politics to be worse, not better.
As you write, is what they're basically saying is you either stand with them or you stand with the forces of Satan. So there's no middle ground. And as you point out, that mindset is not new, but it is dangerous. It leaves no room for the democratic virtue of compromise, because you can't compromise with people who are animated by demonic powers, right? I mean, it makes learning from others who hold different views impossible. It treats critics not as fellow citizens, but as agents of Satan. So in terms of really toxifying the political environment and firing up the culture wars, you could really, it's hard to imagine a more extreme formulation than that one.
I think that that's right. I think it's really pernicious. And then you got to probe the logic of this. Where does this end? Do demonic powers explain opposition to all politicians who are supported by Graham or Metaxas or Trump alone? So I just think that this opens a whole can of worms that is harmful. And beyond that, and I touch on this in the piece in The Atlantic, is I think that this really is discrediting to the Christian witness, particularly among younger people. I mean, they see this kind of moral freak show going on, the rank hypocrisy that a lot of evangelicals have shown during the Trump era. And they don't want anything to do with that movement. They say, look, if this is what Christianity is represented by, if it's embodied by the kind of things that Graham and Metaxas are talking about, then they don't want anything to do with that. And that, I think, is, from my perspective, even more problematic than the political damage they're doing, which is considerable.
No, I wanted to get to this because I think this is something that I saw immediately in reaction to this. You point out that they're really making the job of the so-called new atheists so much easier because, you know, people say, well, if that's what Christianity is, I don't want to have anything to do with it. And you say, when a close friend of mine who is an atheist hears people like Graham and Metaxas speaking as they do, he thinks Christianity is unreasonable, politically weaponized, and utterly unappealing. Now, when I tweeted something out about this yesterday, I was really struck by the responses. And of course, I don't have them all in front of me, and this is more impressionistic than statistical. But it felt like 80 to 90% of them were reacting by saying, "This discredits religion. This is what happens when you engage, you know, when you worship a, you know, fictitious person in the sky." That the people coming out were saying, "You know, this is, you know, religion is the opiate of the people." And so, the way in which, leaving aside the political consequences of it and the political incoherence of it, the impact long term on Christianity has got to be of deep concern to people who actually care about the future of the church.
Yeah, that's well stated, and I agree with it completely. I'll tell you, Charlie, I have heard from any number of pastors from around the country, including the South, people also who have been affiliated with parachurch organizations and others, who have written me about this kind of generational catastrophe that is happening, to use their words, particularly among younger people, both Christians and non-Christians. What's happening is that they're seeing this play out, and they're seeing that there's no Christian distinctive that's being brought into politics. Indeed, what they see happening is that those who are Christians seem to be amplifying all the worst tendencies, all the darkest impulses in American politics. And they say, is this what it's about? Is this a movement I want to be associated with? And that's creating a tremendous amount of distance. One of the reasons that I've written as often as I have on the damage that's being done by a lot of people in the evangelical movement, again, I want to be careful. It's a large movement. There are a lot of very deep and deeply decent people who are a part of it and who have conflicted views on Donald Trump. But some large number of people, and I think Metaxas and Graham embody that. The reason that I speak out against them as often as I have, and I think people like Mike Gerson, who's also a person who's of the Christian faith and an evangelical, is that we think that it's very important that people be offered a different a vision of what Christianity is. Because if people who do have a different vision of Christianity are silent, and the ones who have the microphone and are in front of the camera, like Robert Jeffress and Ralph Reed and Jerry Falwell Jr. And Graham and Metaxas and others, if those are the people who are writing the script, who are writing the narrative, then I think that the Christian faith, the Christian witness is going to be deeply damaged. The faith itself needs to be embodied at its core, its theological core, by things like grace and love and tenderness, righteousness for sure, and moral standards and moral decency. But there is a kind of winsomeness that ought to accompany people who are Christian. Tim Keller once said that if you encountered an atheist and the encounter went well, the response of the atheist should be, I can't believe in what you say, but I wish I could, mm-hmm. because I want to be a part of that community. And I think the opposite thing is going on. You know, it was once said of C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien that they never lost their wonder and enchantment with the world. And there was a kind of winsomeness to them and something lovely and appealing and uplifting in the way that they were able to articulate the Christian faith. And that is true of the most important Christians in history. It's presented Christianity as inviting religion. You know, I mentioned at the end of the Atlantic piece a book that had an impact on me by a friend of mine, Philip Yancey, who's a very popular Christian author, and his book is called What's So Amazing About Grace. And Philip tells about how prior to writing the book, he began asking strangers questions when striking up conversations. And he said, when I say the word evangelical Christian, what comes to mind? And he said that the words that were most often attributed to evangelical Christian were political descriptions. And never once, he said, did he hear the word grace. Now, if you're a person of the Christian faith, grace is at the dead center of Christian theology. And if what's happening is the transmission belt in the way that people are conducting themselves and acting and speaking, that they not only don't see grace, but they see ungrace. And instead, what they see is pulsating anger, rigidity, judgment, resentments, grievances, then those people aren't representing Christ in ways that they're called to. And I really do think that that needs to be called out. It needs to be changed. And we have to rethink what it means to be faithful witnesses in a broken world.
The consequences of this, I think, are going to last for generations. So let's switch gears briefly in the few minutes we have left to talk about impeachment. I know that you and I have had this conversation before, the sort of remarkable development where not just evangelical Christians, but speaking more broadly about conservatives, their willingness to adopt moral relativism, to go along with a post-truth culture that really borders very closely on just pure nihilism. And I guess this is part of my struggle when we started this, the struggle between hope and optimism, because I think the great fear when Donald Trump was elected was the way that he would corrupt the Republican Party and the conservative movement. I have to admit that it's been this rolling process, and here we are today at this moment where you could argue that it was even worse than we feared it would be, where you have across the board this acceptance of the lack of moral standings, the lack of interest in truth versus complete, you know, fabrication. And I guess the question is, where are the voices of the people who still retain a conscience and know this is wrong? I've heard, again, endlessly, you know, the transactional nature, the political fears you have of speaking up. But I guess it's the uniformity that's so disconcerting. The fact that nowhere do you have the best completely lack all conviction, while the worst are filled with passionate intensity. I mean, it feels like that's ramped up on an almost weekly basis.
Yeah, I think that's well said. It's elegantly said. There are very rare exceptions. I think Mitt Romney is one, but I don't think that there are many beyond that. It is disconcerting, it's not shocking, honestly, to me, and I'll tell you why. Because I believed, I think as you believed, with Donald Trump very, very early on, indeed even before he won the presidency, I think this was so clear during the 2016 primary, that this is a person without any moral sense, without any moral compass, and that there was really no bottom, no ethical bottom with him. I don't think that I've said before that I think talking to Trump about morality is probably like trying to describe color to a person who was born colorblind. They simply can't see it. And so this is a person who has no moral sense and is ambitious and narcissistic. I think what happened is that the Republican Party and the Republicans that you and I know and have relationships with over the years never anticipated how low he would go or where he would bring them, the dark alleyways that they would go to. I think that when they made the deal with Trump at the beginning, which was he's the leader of our party, he's the president, and so we're going to have to defend him, I think that they succumbed to wishful thinking, and they thought, look, you know, he's going to do his tweets. He's not interested in governing. And so at the beginning of the Trump presidency, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell would basically do the heavy lifting and he would go along and everything would be fine. What they didn't anticipate is the sort of moral depravity of the man, the pathological lies, the dehumanization, the cruelty, that whole combination of things. But what had happened was that they made that deal, and as you know, at every point, every juncture along the way, they justified their support by Trump by saying, well, we're advancing large causes. We can't let the Democrats win. We've got to push forward an agenda that we believe in. But what happened is that the good that they believed Donald Trump would bring has not in many cases materialized, and the cost to it, the accumulation of moral transgressions and moral accommodations has grown and grown and grown to the point where, as you said, this is now the modern Republican Party is basically the party of postmodernism, of deconstructionism, of what Nietzsche called perspectivism. It's post-truth. And we saw this recently with Senator Kennedy when Chris Wallace was grilling him on Fox News Sunday about whether this crazy conspiracy theory that it was the Ukrainians, not the Russians, that intervened in the 2016 election. And his response was, I don't know, you don't know, nobody knows. This is the party, remember, that stood for truth, objective truth. And push back against postmodernism and deconstructionism. You'll remember in the late 1980s, Alan Bloom wrote a magnificent book called The Closing of the American Mind, and that was a push against relativism, and it was the Republican Party and the conservative movement and figures within the conservative movement who stood against relativism. Now, in this weird turn of events, because of Donald Trump, not simply because of Donald Trump, but he's the manifestation of certain trends that happened that have accelerated. This is now the party of moral relativism. They will defend Donald Trump as best I can tell, whatever he does, come what may. And in my conversations with Trump supporters, when I have tried to push them on what's the limiting principle, what exactly could Donald Trump do that would cause you not to vote for him, not to vote for a Democrat, not to vote for a liberal, but simply not to vote for him. And in many cases in these conversations that I've had with Republicans, they won't name the limiting principle because their argument is, The left is such a threat that we have to defend Donald Trump regardless of what he does. And when that plays itself out, that's the catastrophe that we see before us.
Yeah, and that is the psychological place where I think that they have settled in, that that they can rationalize all of Trump's behavior because it is always Flight 93 election, always. You know, from beginning to end. Peter Wehner, again, thank you. I'm so grateful that you took the time to spend with us today and coming back on the Bulwark Podcast.
Thanks so much, Charlie. It's always great being on, and happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
And you as well. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.